Well, thinks Simon, but men and women are not statues, not lifeless like marble, although they often become so in the hospital surgery after a harrowing period of noisy and leaky distress. He'd quickly discovered at Guy's that he was not fond of blood. But he'd learned some worthwhile lessons nonetheless. How easily people die, for one. How frequently, for another. And how cunningly spirit and body are knit together. A slip of the knife and you create an idiot. If this is so, why not the reverse? Could you sew and snip and patch together a genius? What mysteries remain to be revealed in the nervous system, that web of structures both material and ethereal, that network of threads that runs throughout the body, composed of 1,000 Ariadne's clues, all leading to the brain, that shadowy central den where the human bones lie scattered and the monsters lurk. The angels also, he reminds himself. Also the angels. In the distance he sees a woman walking. She's dressed in black. Her skirt is a soft, rippling bell. Her veil blows out behind her like dark smoke. She turns, looks back briefly. It's Mrs. Humphrey, his somber landlady. Fortunately, she's walking away from him, or she may be deliberately avoiding him, just as well, as he's not in the mood for conversation, and especially not for gratitude. He wonders why she insists on dressing quite so much like a widow. Wishful thinking, perhaps. So far, there's been no news of the Major. Simon paces along the shore, picturing to himself what the Major must be doing. A race course, a bawdy house, a tavern. One of the three. Then he thinks, inconsequentially, about taking off his shoes and wading into the lake. He has a sudden memory of dabbling in the creek at the back of the property as a young boy, in the company of his nursemaid, one of the young millhands turned servant, as were most of their maids then, and getting himself dirty and being scolded by his mother and the nursemaid, too, for allowing it. What was her name? Alice? Or was that later, when he was already at school and in long trousers, and had gone up to the attic on one of his furtive escapades and had been caught by the girl in her room, white-handed, as it were? He'd been fondling one of her shifts. She'd been angry with him, but couldn't express her anger, of course, as she'd wanted to keep her position. So she'd done the womanly thing, and burst into tears. He'd put his arms around her to console her, and they'd ended by kissing. Her cap had fallen off, and her hair came tumbling down. Long, dark blonde hair, voluptuous, none too clean, smelling of curdled milk. Her hands were red as she'd been hulling strawberries, and her mouth tasted of them. There were red smears afterwards on his shirt, from where she'd started to undo his buttons. But it was the first time he'd ever kissed a woman, and he'd been embarrassed and then alarmed and hadn't known what to do next. Probably she'd laughed at him. What a raw boy he'd been then. What a simpleton. He smiles at the memory. It's a picture of more innocent days, and by the time the half hour is up, he feels much better. Reverend Verringer's housekeeper greets him with a disapproving nod. If she were to smile, her face would crack like an eggshell. There must be a school for ugliness, thinks Simon, where such women are sent to be trained. She shows him into the library, where a fire has been lit and two glasses of some unknown cordial set ready. What he would really like is a good stiff whiskey, but there's no hope of that among the teetotaling Methodists. Reverend Verringer has been standing among his leather bindings, but moves forward to welcome Simon. They sit and sip. The brew in the glass tastes like waterweed, with an undertone of raspberry beetles. It is purifying to the blood. My housekeeper makes it herself from an old recipe, says Reverend Verringer. Very old, thinks Simon. Witches come to mind. Has there been any progress with our mutual project? Asks Verringer. Simon has known this question would be asked. Nevertheless, he stumbles a little over the answer. I have been proceeding with the utmost caution, he says. Certainly there are several threads that are worth pursuing. I first needed to establish the grounds for trust, which I believe I have done. After that, I have sought to elicit a family history, Our subject appears to remember her life before arriving at Mr. Kinnear's with a vividness and a mass of circumstantial detail that indicates the problem is not with her memory in general. I have learned about her journey to this country and also the first year of her domestic service, which was not marked by any untoward episodes, with one exception. Which was? Asks Reverend Verringer, lifting his sparse eyebrows. Are you acquainted with a family called Parkinson, in Toronto? I seem to remember them, says Verringer, from my youth. He was an alderman, as I recall, but he died some years ago, and the widow, I believed, returned to her native land. She was an American like herself. She found the winters too cold. That is unfortunate, says Simon. I had hoped to speak with them in order to corroborate certain supposed facts. Grace's first situation was with this family. She had a friend, a fellow servant there, called Mary Whitney, which was, you may recall, the false name she herself gave when escaping to the United States with James McDermott, if indeed it was an escape and not a forced emigration of sorts. In any case, this young woman died under what I must term abrupt circumstances, and while sitting in the room with the body, our subject thought she heard her dead friend speak to her. An auditory hallucination, of course. It is not at all uncommon, says Verringer. I myself have attended a great many deathbeds, and especially among the sentimental and the superstitious, it is counted a mark of dishonor not to have heard the deceased speak. If an angel choir is also audible, so much the better. His tone is dry, and possibly even ironic. Simon is a little surprised. Surely it is the duty of the clergy to encourage pious eyewash. This was followed, he continues, by an episode of fainting, and then by hysterics, mixed with what would appear to have been somnambulism, after which there was a deep and prolonged sleep and subsequent amnesia. Ah, says Verringer, leaning forward. So she has a history of such lapses. We must not jump to conclusions, Simon says judiciously. She herself is at present my only informant. He pauses. He does not wish to appear lacking in tact. It would be exceedingly useful to me in the formation of my professional opinion if I were able to speak with those who knew Grace at the time of the events in question, and who afterwards witnessed her comportment and behavior in the penitentiary during the first years of her incarceration, and also in the asylum. I myself was not present upon those occasions, says Reverend Verringer. I have read Mrs. Moody's account, says Simon. She has a great deal to say that interests me. According to her, Kenneth Mackenzie, the lawyer, visited Grace in the penitentiary some 6 or 7 years after she was imprisoned, and was told by Grace that Nancy Montgomery was haunting her, that her two bloodshot and blazing eyes were following her around, and appearing in such locations as her lap and her soup plate. Mrs. Moody herself saw Grace in the asylum, the violent ward, I believe, and portrays a gibbering madwoman, shrieking like a phantom and running about like a singed monkey. Of course, her account was written before she could know that in less than a year Grace would be discharged from the asylum as, if not perfectly sane, then sane enough to be returned to the penitentiary. One does not have to be entirely sane for that, says Verringer, with a short laugh like a hinge creaking. I have thought of paying a visit to Mrs. Moody, says Simon, but I seek your advice. I am not sure how to question her without casting aspersions on the veracity of what she has set down. Veracity, says Verringer blandly. He doesn't sound surprised. There are discrepancies that are beyond dispute, says Simon. For instance, Mrs. Moody is unclear about the location of Richmond Hill. She is inaccurate on the subject of names and dates. She calls several of the actors in this tragedy by names that are not their own, and she has conferred a military rank on Mr. Kinnear that he appears not to have merited. A post-mortem medal, perhaps, Verringer murmurs. Simon smiles. Also, she has the culprits cutting Nancy Montgomery's body up into quarters before hiding it under the washtub, which surely was not done. The newspapers would hardly have failed to mention a detail so sensational. I'm afraid the good woman did not realize how difficult it is to cut up a body, never having done so herself. It makes one wonder, in short, about other things. The motive for the murders, for example. She puts it down to a wild jealousy on the part of Grace, who envied Nancy her possession of Mr. Kinnear, and lechery on the part of McDermott, who was promised a quid pro quo for his services as butcher, in the form of Grace's favors. That was the popular view at the time. No doubt, says Simon, the public will always prefer a salacious melodrama to a bald tale of mere thievery. But you can see that one might have one's reservations also about the bloodshot eyes. Mrs. Moody, says Reverend Verringer, has stated publicly that she is very fond of Charles Dickens, and in especial of Oliver Twist. I seem to recall a similar pair of eyes in that work, also belonging to a dead female called Nancy. How shall I put it? Mrs. Moody is subject to influences. You might like to read Mrs. Moody's poem, The Maniac, if you are an aficionado of Sir Walter Scott. Her poem contains all the requirements: a cliff, a moon, a raging sea, a betrayed maiden chanting a wild melody and clad in unhealthily damp garments, with, as I recall, her streaming hair festooned with botanical specimens. I believe she ends by leaving off the picturesque cliff so thoughtfully provided for her. Oh, let me see. And closing his eyes and beating time with his right hand, he recites, "The wind waved her garments, and April's rash showers hung like gems in her dark locks, enwreathed with wild flowers. Her bosom was bare to the cold midnight storm that unsparingly beat on her thin, fragile form. Her black eyes flashed sternly whence reason had fled, and she glanced on my sight like some ghost of the dead, as she sang a loud strain to the hoarse, dashing surge that rang on my ears like the plaint of a dirge. And he who had left her to madness and shame, who had robbed her of honor and blasted her fame, did he think in that hour of the heart he had riven, the vows he had broken, the anguish he'd given? And where was the infant whose birth gave the blow to the peace of his mother and maddened her woe?" He opens his eyes again. "Where, indeed?" he says. "You astonish me," says Simon. "You must have an extraordinary memory." "Four verse of a certain type, unfortunately, yes. It comes from too much hymn-singing," says Reverend Verringer. "Though God himself chose to write a good deal of the Bible in poetry, which demonstrates his approval of the form as such, however indifferently it may be practiced. Nevertheless, one cannot quibble with Mrs. Moody's morals, but I'm sure you take my meaning. Mrs. Moody is a literary lady, and like all such, and indeed, like the sex in general, she is inclined to embroider," says Simon. "Precisely," says Reverend Verringer. "Everything I say here is strictly confidential, of course. Although Tories at the time of the rebellion, the Moodies have since seen the error of their ways, and are now staunchly reform, for which they have been made to suffer by certain malicious persons who are in a position to torment them with lawsuits and the like. I would not say a word against the lady, but I would also not advise a visit. I understand, by the by, that the spiritualists have got hold of her." "Indeed," says Simon. "So I hear. She was, for a long time, a skeptic, and her husband was the first convert of the two. No doubt she became tired of spending the evenings alone, while he was off listening to phantom trumpets and conversing with the spirits of Goethe and Shakespeare. I take it you do not approve." "Ministers of my denomination have been expelled from the church for dabbling in these, to my mind, unholy proceedings," says Reverend Verringer. "It is true that some members of our committee have partaken, are devotees, in fact. But I must bear with them until this madness has run its course and they have come to their senses. As Mr. Nathaniel Hawthorne has said, the thing is a humbug, and if it is not, so much the worse for us. For the spirits who present themselves at table turnings and the like must be those who have failed to get into the eternal world, and are still cluttering up ours like a kind of spiritual dust. It is unlikely they wish us well, and the less we have to say to them, the better.
Hawthorne, says Simon. He is surprised to find a clergyman reading Hawthorne. The man has been accused of sensualism, and, especially after the Scarlet Letter, of a laxity in morals. One must keep up with one's flock.
But, as to Grace Marks and her earlier behavior, you would be better to consult Mr. Kenneth Mackenzie, who acted for her at the trial, and who, I understand, has a sound head on his shoulders. He is currently a partner in a Toronto law firm, having made a rapid professional rise. I shall address a letter of introduction to him. I'm sure he will accommodate you.
Thank you, says Simon.
I am pleased to have had this chance to talk with you in private, before the advent of the ladies, but I hear them arriving now.
The ladies? Says Simon.
The governor's wife and her daughters are favoring us with their company this evening, says Verringer. The governor himself is, unfortunately, away on business.
Did I not inform you?
Two spots of color appear, one on each of his pale cheeks. Let us go to welcome them, shall we?
Only one daughter is present. Marianne, says her mother, has been kept to her bed with a cold.
Simon is alerted. He is familiar with such ruses. He knows the cabals of mothers. The governor's wife has decided to give Lydia an unimpeded shot at him without any distraction from Marianne. Perhaps he should reveal the smallness of his income immediately, so as to forestall her. But Lydia is a confection, and he doesn't wish to deprive himself of such an aesthetic pleasure too soon. As long as no declarations are made, no harm will be done, and he enjoys being gazed at by eyes as luminous as hers. The season has now officially changed. Lydia has burst into spring bloom. Layers of pale floral ruffling have sprouted all over her and wave from her shoulders like diaphanous wings. Simon eats his fish, overdone, but no one on this continent can poach a fish properly, and admires the smooth white contours of her throat and what can be seen of her bosom. It's as if she is sculpted of whipped cream. She should be on the platter instead of the fish. He's heard stories of a famous Parisian courtesan who had herself presented at a banquet in this way, naked, of course. He occupies himself with undressing and then garnishing Lydia. She should be garlanded with flowers, ivory-colored, shell-pink, and with, perhaps, a border of hothouse grapes and peaches. Her pop-eyed mother is as finely strung as ever. She fingers the jet beads at her throat and digs almost at once into the serious business of the evening. The Tuesday Circle fervently longs to have Dr. Jordan address it. Nothing too formal, an earnest discussion among friends, friends of his too, she hopes she may assume, who are interested in the same important causes. Perhaps he could say a few words on the abolition question. It is of such concern to them all. Simon says he's not an expert on it. Indeed, he isn't well informed at all, having been in Europe for the past few years. In that case, suggests Reverend Verringer, perhaps Dr. Jordan would be so kind as to share with them the latest theories concerning nervous illnesses and insanity. That, too, would be most welcome, as one of their long-standing projects, as a group, is the reform of public asylums. Dr. Dupont says he would be especially interested, says the governor's wife. Dr. Jerome Dupont, whose acquaintance you have already made, he has such a breadth of... He has such a wide range of things that interest him.
Oh, I would find that fascinating, says Lydia, looking at Simon from under her long dark lashes. I hope you will.
She hasn't said much this evening, but then she hasn't had much chance except to refuse the offers of more fish that have been pressed upon her by Reverend Verringer.
I have always wondered what it would be like to go mad. Grace won't tell me. Simon has a picture of himself in a shadowy corner with Lydia, behind a drapery, a heavy mauve brocade. If he were to encircle her waist with his arm, gently, so as not to alarm her, would she sigh? Would she yield or push him away? Or both? Back in his lodgings, he pours himself a large glass of sherry from the bottle he keeps in the armoire. He hasn't had a drink all evening. The beverage at Verringer's supper party was water. But somehow he's as fuzzy-headed as if he had. Why did he agree to address the devilish Tuesday circle? What are they to him, or he to them? What can he say to them that would make any sense to them at all, considering their lack of expertise? It was Lydia, her admiration, her appeal. He feels as if he's been ambushed by a flowering shrub. He's too exhausted to stay up late and read and work as usual. He goes to bed and sleeps at once. Then he's dreaming, an uneasy dream. He's in a fenced yard where laundry flaps on a line. No one else is there, which gives him a sensation of clandestine pleasure. The sheets and linens move in the wind as if worn by invisible swelling hips, as if alive. As he watches, he must be a boy. He's short enough to be looking upwards. A scarf or veil of white muslin is blown from the line and undulates gracefully through the air like a long bandage unrolling, or like paint in water. He runs to catch it, out of the yard, down the road, he's in the country then, and into a field, an orchard. The cloth has tangled in the branches of a small tree covered with green apples. He tugs it down and it falls across his face, and then he understands that it isn't cloth at all, but hair, the long, fragrant hair of an unseen woman, which is twining around his neck. He struggles. He is being closely embraced. He can scarcely breathe. The sensation is painful and almost unbearably erotic. And he wakes with a jolt. Today I am in the sewing room before Dr. Jordan. There's no sense in wondering what has delayed him, as gentlemen keep their own hours. So I continue to sew while singing a little to myself. Rock of ages, cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood from thy riven side which flowed be of sin the double cure. Cleanse me from its guilt and power. I like this song, as it makes me think of rocks and water and the seashore which are outside, and thinking of a thing is next best to being there. I did not know you could sing so well, Grace, says Dr. Jordan, coming into the room. You have a beautiful voice. He has dark circles under his eyes and looks as if he hasn't slept a wink. Thank you, sir, I say. I used to have more occasion for it than I do now. He sits down and takes out his notebook and pencil and also a parsnip, which he places on the table. It is not one I would have selected, having an orange tint, which means they are old. Oh, a parsnip, I say. Does it bring anything to mind? He asks. Well, there is fine words, but are no parsnips, I say. Also, they are very hard to peel. They are kept in cellars, I believe, he says. Oh, no, sir, I reply. Outside, in a hole in the ground with straw, as they are much improved by being frozen. He looks at me in a tired fashion, and I wonder what has been causing his loss of sleep. Perhaps it is some young lady which is on his mind and not returning his affection, or else he has not been eating regular meals. Shall we continue with your story where we left off? He says. I've forgotten just where that was, I say. This is not quite true, but I wish to see if he has really been listening to me or just pretending to. With Mary's death, he says, your poor friend Mary Whitney. Ah, yes, I say. With Mary. Well, sir, the way in which Mary died was hushed up as much as possible. That she had died of a fever may or may not have been believed, but nobody said no to it out loud. Nor did anyone deny that she'd left her things to me in view of what she had written down, though there was some raised eyebrows at her writing it, as if she'd known ahead of time that she was going to die. But I said rich people made their wills beforehand, so why not marry? And then they said no more. Nor was anything said about the writing paper and how she had got hold of it. I sold her box, which was good quality, and also her best dress, to Jeremiah the peddler, who came round again just after her death, and I also sold him the gold ring which she had kept hidden under the floor. I told him it was to pay for a decent burial, and he gave me a fair price and more. He said he'd seen death in Mary's face, but then hindsight is always accurate. He also said he was sorry for her death and would say a prayer for her, although what sort of prayer I could not imagine, as he was a heathenish sort of man with all his tricks and fortune-telling. But surely the form of prayer does not matter, and the only distinction God makes is between good will and ill, or so I have come to believe. It was Agnes who helped me with the burial. We put flowers from Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's garden into the coffin, having asked permission, and it being June, there were long-stemmed roses and peonies, and we chose only the white ones. I scattered the petals of them over her as well, and I slipped in the needle case I'd made for her, but out of sight, as it might look wrong otherwise, being red. And I cut a piece off the back of her hair to remember her by, and tied it together with a thread. She was buried in her best nightdress, and she didn't look dead in the least, but only asleep and very pale, and laid out all in white like that, she was just like a bride. The coffin was pine boards and very plain, as I wanted a stone grave marker, too, for the money, but I had only enough for her name. I would have liked a poem such as, "From earth's dark shadows, though you flee, when in heaven remember me," but it was greatly beyond my means. She was put with the Methodists on Adelaide Street, off in a corner, right next to the paupers, but still within the churchyard, so I felt I had done all for her that I could. Agnes and two of the other servants were the only ones present, as a suspicion must have gone around that Mary had died under a shadow. And when they shoveled the dirt in on top of the coffin, and the young minister said, "Dust to dust," I cried as if my heart would break. I was thinking of my poor mother as well, who'd had no proper burial with dirt on top the way it should be, but was just tossed into the sea. It was very hard for me to believe that Mary was truly dead. I kept expecting her to come into the room, and when I laid in bed at night, I sometimes thought I could hear her breathing, or she would be laughing just outside the door. Every Sunday I would lay flowers on her grave, not for Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's garden, as that was just the one special occasion, but wild flowers that I would pick in the waste lots or beside the lake shore, or wherever I could find them growing. Soon after Mary's death I left Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's. I didn't like to stay, as ever since Mary had died, Mrs. Alderman Parkinson and Mrs. Honey were not friendly towards me. They must have thought I'd helped Mary in her relations with the gentleman whose name they believed I knew, and although I had not, it is hard to put an end to suspicion once it has begun. When I said I wished to leave my situation, Mrs. Alderman Parkinson did not protest, but instead had me into the library and asked very earnestly once more if I knew the man, and when I said I did not, she asked me to swear on the Bible that even if I did, I would not divulge it, and she would write me a good reference. I did not like being mistrusted in this manner, but I did as required, and Mrs. Alderman Parkinson wrote the reference and said kindly that she never had any fault to find with my work, and gave me a present of $2 upon my leaving, which was generous, and found me another situation with Mr. Dixon, who was also an alderman. At Dixon's, I was paid more, as I was now trained and with a reference. Dependable servants were scarce, as many had left for the States after the rebellion, and although there were new immigrants arriving all the time, the deficiency was not yet made up, and help was much in demand. And because of this, I knew that I did not have to stay in any place if I did not like it. I found I did not like it at Mr. Dixon's, as I felt they knew too much of the story and treated me strangely. So, after half a year, I gave notice and went to Mr. McManus's, but I was not well suited there, as I was only one of two servants, the other being a hired man who talked a great deal about the end of the world and the tribulation and the gnashing of teeth, and was not much company at meals. I stayed only 3 months, and was hired away by Mr. Coates, and stayed until some months after my 15th birthday. But there was another servant who was jealous of me, as I was more careful in my work than she was. So, when I heard of the opportunity, I went to Mr. Harrigy, at the same wages as at Coates. That went on well enough for a time, but I began to be uneasy as Mr. Harrigy attempted liberties in the back passage while I was carrying out the dishes from the dining room, and although I remembered Mary's advice about kicking between the legs, I thought it would not be right to kick my employer and might also lead to dismissal without a reference. But then one night I heard him outside the door of my attic chamber. I recognized his wheezy cough. He was fumbling with the latch of the door. I always locked myself in at night, but I knew that lock or no lock, sooner or later he would find a way of getting in, with a ladder if nothing else, and I couldn't sleep easy for thinking of it, and I needed my sleep as I was very tired from the day's work. And once you are found with a man in your room, you are the guilty one, no matter how they get in. As Mary used to say, there are some of the masters who think you owe them service 24 hours a day, and should do the main work flat on your back. I believe Mrs. Harrigy suspected something of the sort. She was from a good family fallen upon hard times, and she'd had to take pot luck in the way of a husband, and Mr. Harrigy had made his fortune in hog butchering. I doubt it was the first time Mr. Harrigy had behaved in this way, because when I gave notice, Mrs. Harrigy did not even ask me why, but sighed and said I was a good girl and wrote me a reference right away on her best writing paper. I went to Mr. Watson's. I could have done better if I'd had the time to look about me, but I'd felt speed was necessary, as Mr. Harrigy had come wheezing and panting into the scullery while I was scouring the pots, with my hands all covered with grease and smuts, and had attempted to seize hold of me despite it, and that was the sign of a desperate man. Mr. Watson was a shoemaker, and in great need of help, with a wife and 3 children and a 4th on the way, and he had only 1 servant, who was not up to all the washing, although a good plain cook, and so he was willing to pay me $2.50 a month and a pair of shoes into the bargain. I needed shoes, as the ones I had from Mary's things did not fit properly, and my own were almost worn through, and new shoes were very expensive. I was there only a short time before I made the acquaintance of Nancy Montgomery, who came to visit, having grown up in the country with Mrs. Watson's cook, Sally. Nancy was in Toronto to make some purchases at a dry goods auction down at Clarkson's Stores. She showed us some very pretty crimson silk which she'd bought for a winter dress, and I wondered what a housekeeper would be wanting with a dress like that, and some fine gloves, and an Irish linen tablecloth on behalf of her employer. She said it was better to buy at auction than from a store, as the prices were cheaper, and her master liked to stretch a penny. She had not taken the coach into town, but had been driven in by her master, which she said was much more comfortable, as you did not have to be jostled by strangers. Nancy Montgomery was very handsome, dark-haired, and of about 24 years of age. She had beautiful brown eyes, and she laughed and joked much as Mary Whitney had done, and seemed very good-natured. She sat in the kitchen and took a cup of tea, and she and Sally talked over old times. They'd gone to school together north of the city, it being the first school in the district, and conducted by the local minister on Saturday mornings, when the children could be spared from their work. It was held in a log house, more like a stable, said Nancy, and they had to walk to it through the forest, and were always afraid of bears, which were more numerous then. And one day they did see a bear, and Nancy ran away screaming and climbed a tree. Sally said the bear was more frightened than Nancy was, and Nancy said it was probably a gentleman bear, and it was running away from something dangerous that it had never seen before, but might have caught a glimpse of as she climbed the tree, and they laughed very much. They told about how the boys pushed over a privy at the back of the school while one of the girls was in it, and they hadn't warned the girl, but watched along with all the others, and then they felt wrong about it afterwards. Sally said it was always the shy ones like that who got picked on, and Nancy said, yes, but you had to learn to stand up for yourself in this life, and I thought that was true. While gathering her shawl and things together, she had a lovely parasol, pink in color, although in need of cleaning. Nancy told me she was housekeeper to Mr. Thomas Kinnear, Esquire, who lived in Richmond Hill, up Young Street, past Gallows Hill and Hogs Hollow. She said she was in want of another servant to help her with the work, the house being large, and the girl who was there before having left to get married. Mr. Kinnear was a gentleman of a fine Scottish family, and easy-going in his habits, and was not married. So there was less work, and no mistress of the household to carp and criticize, and would I be interested in the position? She claimed to be lonely for some female company, as Mr. Kinnear's farm was a distance from the town. Also, she didn't like being there all by herself, a single woman alone with a gentleman, as people would talk, and I thought this showed a right feeling. She said that Mr. Kinnear was a liberal master, and showed it when he was pleased, and that if I accepted I'd be making a good bargain and taking a step up in the world. Then she asked what my wages were at present, and said she would pay $3 a month, and I found this more than fair. Nancy said she had business in the city in a week's time and could wait until then to hear my decision, and I spent the week turning the matter over in my mind. I did worry about being out in the country rather than in town, as I was now used to Toronto life. There was so much to see while walking out on errands, and sometimes there were shows and fairs, although you had to watch for thieves there, and outdoor preachers, and always a boy or a woman singing on the street for pennies. I'd seen a man eat fire, and another that could throw his voice, and a pig that could count, and a dancing bear with a muzzle on, only it was more like lurching, and the ragamuffins poked it with sticks. Also, it would be muddier in the country, without the fine raised sidewalks, and no gas lighting at night, nor grand shops, and so many church spires, and smart carriages, and new brick banks with pillars. But I reflected that if I did not like it in the country, I could always come back. When I asked Sally's opinion, she said she didn't know if it was a suitable position for a young girl like me. And when I asked her why not, she said Nancy had always been kind to her, and she didn't like to talk. And a person had to take her own chances, and least said, soonest mended. And as she did not know anything for certain, it would not be right for her to say any more. But she felt she'd done her duty by me in saying as much as she had, because I had no mother to advise me, and I didn't have the least idea of what she was talking about. I asked her if she'd heard any harm spoken of Mr. Kinnear, and she said nothing that the world at large would call harm. It was like a puzzle I could not guess, and it would have been better for all if she'd spoken out more plainly, but the pay was higher than what I'd ever had before, which weighed heavily with me, and what weighed even more heavily was Nancy Montgomery herself. She resembled Mary Whitney, or so I then thought, and I'd been depressed in spirits ever since Mary's death, and so I decided to go. Nancy had given me the fare, and so on the day agreed I took the early coach. It was a long journey, as Richmond Hill was 16 miles up Yonge Street. Directly north of the city the road was not too bad, although there was more than one steep hill where we had to get out and walk. Otherwise, the horses could not pull us up. Beside the ditches there were many flowers growing, daisies and such, with butterflies flying about. And these parts of the road were very pretty. I thought of picking a bouquet, but then it would be sure to wilt along the way. After a time the road was worse, with deep ruts and stones, and jolting and bumping enough to unhinge your bones, and dust fit to choke you on the tops of the hills, and mud in the low places, and logs laid crossways over the bogs. They said that when it rained the road was no better than a swamp, and in March, during the spring runoff, you could barely travel at all. The best time was the winter, when all was frozen hard and a sleigh could make good headway, but then there was the risk of blizzards, and of freezing to death if the sleigh overturned. And sometimes there were snowdrifts as high as a house, and your only chance was a little prayer and a great deal of whiskey. All of this and more was told me by the man who sat squeezed beside me, who said he was a dealer in farm implements and seed grains, and claimed to know the road well. Some of the houses we passed along the way were large and fine, but others were just log houses, low and poor-looking. The fences around the fields were of different kinds, snake fences of split rails, and others made of the tree roots pulled out of the ground, which looked like giant hanks of wooden hair. Every now and then there was a crossroads with a few houses close together and an inn, where the horses could be rested or changed and a glass of whiskey taken. Some of the men hanging about had taken a good many more than one glass, and were shabbily dressed and impertinent, and came up to the coach where I sat and tried to look under the rim of my bonnet. When we stopped at midday, The dealer in farm implements said would I care to go inside and take a glass with him and some refreshments, but I said no, as a respectable woman should not go into such places with a stranger. I had bread and cheese with me and could get a drink of water from the well in the courtyard, and that was enough for me. For the journey I'd put on my good summer things. I had a straw bonnet, trimmed with a blue ribbon bow from Mary's box, and my cap under it, and a cotton print dress with the drop-shouldered sleeves which were going out of style then, but I'd had no time to make it over. It was once red dots, but had washed to pink, and I had it as part wages from Coates's. Two petticoats, one torn but neatly mended, the other now too short, but who was there to see it? A cotton chemise and a pair of stays, used, from Jeremiah the peddler, and white cotton stockings, mended but still with good wear in them. The pair of shoes from Mr. Watson, the shoemaker, which were not the best quality and did not fit, as the best shoes came from England. A summer shawl of green muslin, and a kerchief left to me by Mary, which had been her mother's. A white ground printed with small blue flowers, love in a mist, folded into a triangle and worn around the neck to keep the sun off and prevent freckles. It was comforting to have such a remembrance of her, but I had no gloves. No one had ever given me any, and they were too dear for me to buy. My winter things, my red flannel petticoat and my heavy dress, my wool stockings and my flannel nightdress, as well as two cotton for summer, and my summer working dress and clogs and two caps and an apron and my other shift, were tied in a bundle with my mother's shawl and carried on top of the coach. It was well strapped down, but I was anxious about it the entire journey, as I worried that it would fall off and be lost in the road, and I kept looking behind. "Never look behind you," said the dealer in farm implements. "Why not?" said I. "I knew you were not supposed to talk with strange men, but it was hard to avoid as we were crammed in so close together." "Because the past is the past," he said, "and regret is vain. Let bygones be bygones. You know what became of Lot's wife," he went on. "Turned to a pillar of salt she was, a waste of a good woman, not that they aren't all the better for a touch of salt." And he laughed. I was not sure what he meant, but suspected it was nothing good, and thought I would not talk with him any further. The mosquitoes were very bad, especially in the marshy places and at the edge of the forests, because although some of the land next the road had been cleared, there were still big stands of trees, and very tall and dark. The air in the forest had a different smell to it. It was cool and damp and smelled of moss and of earth and old leaves. I did not trust the forest, as it was full of wild animals such as bears and wolves, and I remembered Nancy's story about the bear. The dealer in farm implements said, "Would you be afraid to go into the forest, miss?" And I said, "No, I would not be afraid, but I would not go in there unless I had to." And he said, "Just as well, young women should not go into the forest by themselves. You never know what may happen to them. There was one found recently with her clothes torn off and her head at some distance from her body." And I said, "Oh, was it bears?" And he said, "The bears or the Red Indians. You know, these woods are full of them. They could swoop out at any minute and have your bonnet off you in a trice and then your scalp. You know, they like to cut off ladies' hair. They can sell it for a good price in the States." And then he said, "I expect you have a good head of hair on you underneath your cap." And all this time he was pressing up against me in a way I was finding offensive. I knew he was lying, if not about the bears, then surely about the Indians. And he was only trying to horrify me. So I said quite pert, "I'd trust my head to the Red Indians sooner than I'd trust it to you." And he laughed, but I was in earnest. I'd seen Red Indians in Toronto, as they would sometimes go there to collect their treaty money, and others would come to the back door at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's with baskets to sell and fish. They kept their faces still, and you could not tell what they were thinking, but they went away when told to. Still, I was glad when we would come out of the forest again and see the fences and houses and the washing hanging out, and smell the smoke from the cooking fires and the trees being burnt for their ashes. After a time, we passed the remains of a building, just the foundations, all blackened, and the dealer pointed it out and told me it was the celebrated Montgomery's Tavern, which was where Mackenzie and his band of ragtags held their seditious meetings and set out to march down Yonge Street during the rebellion. A man was shot in front of it going to warn the government troops, and it was burnt down afterwards. "They hanged some of those traitors, but not enough," said the dealer. and that cowardly rascal Mackenzie should be dragged back from the States, which was where he ran off to, leaving his friends to swing at the rope's end for him. The dealer had a flask in his pocket, and by this time a strong dose of bottle courage, as I could tell by the smell of his breath. And when they're in that state, it is just as well not to provoke them, and so I said nothing. We reached Richmond Hill in the late afternoon. It did not look like much of a town. It was more like a village, with the houses strung out in a line along Young Street. I descended at the coaching inn there, which was the place agreed on with Nancy, and the coachman lifted my bundle down for me. The dealer in farm implements got down, too, and asked where I was staying, and I said what he didn't know wouldn't hurt him. At that he took hold of my arm and said I must come into the inn with him and have a drink or two of whiskey for old time's sake, as we had become so well acquainted in the coach. And I tried to pull my arm away, but he would not let go and was becoming familiar, and was trying to encircle my waist, and several idle men were cheering him on. I looked around for Nancy, but she was nowhere to be seen. What a bad impression it would make, I thought, to be found struggling with a drunken man at an inn. The door to the inn was standing open, and out of it at that moment came Jeremiah the peddler, with his pack on his back, and his long walking stick in his hand. I was very glad to see him, and called out his name, and he looked over in a puzzled way, and then hurried over. "Why, it is Grace Marks," he said. "I did not expect to see you here." "Nor I you," I said, and I smiled, but was somewhat flustered because of the dealer in farm implements who was still hanging on to my arm. "Is this man a friend of yours?" said Jeremiah. "No, he is not," I said. "The lady does not desire your company," said Jeremiah in his pretend voice of an elegant gentleman, and the dealer in farm implements said I was no lady, and added some things which were not compliments, and also some hard words about Jeremiah's mother. Jeremiah took his stick and brought it down on the man's arm, and he let go of me, and then Jeremiah pushed him, and he staggered backwards against the wall of the inn, and sat down in a pat of horse dung, at which the others now jeered at him, as that sort will always jeer at those who are getting the worst of it. "Do you have a situation in the neighborhood?" asked Jeremiah, when I'd thanked him. I said I did, and he said he would come round and see what he could sell me, and just then a third man came up. "Would your name be Grace Marks?" he said, or something of the sort. I cannot remember his exact words. I said it was. And he said he was Mr. Thomas Kinnear, my new employer, and he'd come to fetch me. He had a light wagon with one horse. I found out later that his name was Charlie, for Charlie Horse. He was a bay gelding and very handsome, with such a beautiful mane and tail and large brown eyes, and I loved him dearly at first sight. Mr. Kinnear had the ostler put my bundle in the back of the wagon. There were some packages in it already, and he said, "Well, you have not been in town 5 minutes, and you have managed to attract two gentlemen admirers." And I said they were not, and he said, "Not gentlemen or not admirers?" And I was confused and did not know what he wanted me to say. Then he said, "Up you go, Grace." And I said, "Oh, do you mean me to sit at the front?" And he said, "Well, we can hardly have you in back like a piece of luggage." And he handed me up to sit beside him. I was quite embarrassed, as I was not used to sitting beside a gentleman like him, and especially one who was my employer. But he didn't seem to give it a second thought, and got up on the other side and clicked to the horse, and there we were, driving up Young Street just as if I was a fine lady, and I thought that any of those looking out their windows at us would have had something to gossip about. But as I later found, Mr. Kinnear was never a man to pay any attention to gossip, as he didn't care a pin what other people said about him. He had his own money, and was not running for political office, and could afford to ignore such things. "What did Mr. Kinnear look like?" asks Dr. Jordan. "He had a gentlemanly bearing, sir," I say, "and a mustache." "Is that all?" says Dr. Jordan. "You did not observe him very particularly." "I did not wish to gape at him," I say, "and once in the wagon, of course I did not look at him. I would have needed to turn my whole head because of my bonnet. I suppose you have never worn a bonnet, have you, sir?" "No, I have not," says Dr. Jordan. He is smiling with his lopsided smile. "I expect it is confining," he says. "It is that, sir," I say. "I did see his gloves, though, on his hands holding the reins. Pale yellow gloves they were, soft leather, and so well made they fit with scarcely a wrinkle, you'd think they were his own skin. I was all the more sorry that I did not have any gloves myself, and kept my hands tucked well in under the folds of my shawl. "I suppose you are very tired, Grace," he said, and I said, "Yes, sir," and he said, "The weather is very warm," and I said, "Yes, sir." And so we went along, and to tell you the truth, it was harder than riding in the bumping coach beside the farm implements dealer. I can't say why, as Mr. Kinnear was much more kind. But Richmond Hill was not a very big place, and we were soon through it. He lived past the edge of the village, more than a mile to the north of it. At last we were going past his orchard and up his driveway, which was curved, and about 100 yards long, and ran between two lines of maple trees of medium size. There was the house at the end of the drive, with a veranda along the front of it and white pillars, a big house, but not as big as Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's. From the back of the house came the sound of chopping. There was a boy sitting on the fence. He was perhaps 14 years old, and when we drove up he jumped down and came to hold the horse. He had red hair, raggedly cut, and the freckles to go with it. Mr. Kinnear said to him, "Hello, Jamie, here is Grace Marks come all the way from Toronto. I found her at the inn." And the boy looked up at me and grinned, as if he thought there was something funny about me. But he was only shy and awkward. There were flowers planted in front of the veranda, white peonies and pink roses, and a gracefully dressed lady with a triple flounce was cutting them. She had a flat basket over her arm to put them in. When she heard our wheels and the horse's hoofs on the gravel, she straightened up and shaded her eyes with her hand, and I saw she was wearing gloves. And then I recognized that this woman was Nancy Montgomery. She was wearing a bonnet the same pale color as her dress. It was as if she'd put on her best clothes to go out front and cut the flowers. She waved a hand daintily in my direction, but she made no move to come over to me. And something squeezed tight about my heart. Getting up into the wagon was one thing, but getting down was another, because Mr. Kinnear did not help me down. He swung out by himself and hurried up the walk towards the front of the house, and bent his head down toward Nancy's bonnet, leaving me to sit in the wagon like a sack of potatoes, or else scramble down unaided, which is what I did. A man had come out from the back. He was holding an axe, so it must have been him doing the chopping. He had a thick woven jacket over one shoulder, and his shirt had the sleeves rolled up and was open at the neck with a red bandana tied around, and he had loose trousers tucked into his boot tops. He was dark-haired and slender and not very tall, and did not appear to be more than 21. He said nothing, but stared at me, suspicious and frowning a little, almost as if I was an enemy of his. Yet he did not seem to be looking at me at all, but at someone else right behind me. The boy Jamie said to him, "This is Grace Marks." But he still didn't say anything. And then Nancy called, "McDermott, take the horse in, won't you, and Grace's things. Take them to her room, and you can show her where it is." At that he flushed up as if in anger, and jerked his head curtly for me to come with him. I stood there for an instant, with the late sunlight in my eyes, looking at Nancy and Mr. Kinnear beside the peonies. They were surrounded by a golden haze, as if gold dust had fallen down out of the sky all over them. And I heard her laughing. I was hot and tired and hungry and covered with dust from the road, and she had not given me one word of greeting. Then I followed the horse and wagon towards the back of the house. The boy Jamie walked along beside me, and he said shyly, "Is it big, Toronto? Is it very grand? I've never been there." But I only said, "Grand enough." I could not find it in me to answer him about Toronto, because right then I was bitterly sorry I had ever left it. When I close my eyes, I can remember every detail of that house as clear as a picture. The veranda with the flowers, the windows and the white pillars in the bright sunlight, and I could walk every room of it blindfolded, though at that moment I had no particular feeling about it and only wanted a drink of water. It is strange to reflect that of all the people in that house, I was the only one of them left alive in 6 months' time. Except for Jamie Walsh, of course. But he was not living there. McDermott showed me to the room that was to be mine, which was off the winter kitchen. He was not very civil about it. All he said was, "You're to sleep in here." While I was untying my bundle, Nancy came in, and now she was all smiles. She said, "I'm very glad to see you, Grace. I'm glad you have come." She sat me down at the table in the winter kitchen, which was cooler than the summer kitchen, as the stove was not lit, and she showed me where I could wash my face and hands at the sink, and then she gave me a glass of small beer and some cold beef from the larder, and said, "You must be tired after your journey. It is very fatiguing," and sat with me while I ate, as gracious as could be. She had on a very handsome pair of earrings, which I could tell were real gold, and I wondered how she could afford them on the salary of a housekeeper. After I'd finished refreshing myself, she showed me over the house and outbuildings. The summer kitchen was entirely separate from the main house, so as not to heat it up, a sensible arrangement which ought to be adopted by all. Each of the kitchens had a flagged floor and a good-sized iron stove with a flat apron in the front for keeping things warm, which was the latest model then, and each kitchen had its own sink with a pipe running out to the cesspool and its own scullery and larder. The pump for the water was in the courtyard between the two kitchens. I was pleased it was not an open well, as such wells are more dangerous. Things can fall down into them, and they often harbor rats. Behind the summer kitchen was the stable, adjoining the carriage house, where the wagon was kept. There was enough room in the carriage house for two carriages, but Mr. Kinnear only had the one light wagon. I suppose a real carriage would have been useless on those roads. In the stable there were four stalls, but Mr. Kinnear kept only one cow and two horses, Charlie Horse, and a colt who was to be a riding horse when grown. The harness room was off the winter kitchen, which was unusual and also inconvenient. There was a loft room over the stable, and that was where McDermott slept. Nancy told me he'd only been there a week or so, and though he was prompt enough when Mr. Kinnear was giving the orders, he appeared to have a grudge against her and was impertinent, and I said that possibly his grudge was against the world because he had been short with me as well. Nancy said as far as she was concerned he could mend his ways or be off out of it, because there was lots more where he came from, as out-of-work soldiers were to be had for the asking. I have always liked the smell of a stable. I patted the colt's nose and said good day to Charlie, and I greeted the cow as well because it would be my job to milk her, and I hoped we would start off on good terms. McDermott was setting out straw for the animals. He did not speak to us much more than a grunt, and he gave Nancy a scowling look, and I could see there was no love lost. And when we were going out of the stable, Nancy said, "He is more surly than ever. Well, he can suit himself and welcome. It's a smile or the open road for him, or more likely the bottom of a ditch." And then she laughed, and I hoped he had not overheard it. After that we saw the hen house and the hen yard, which had a woven willow fence around it to keep the chickens in, although it was not much good at keeping the foxes and the weasels out, and the raccoons, too, which were known to be great stealers of eggs, and the kitchen garden, which was well planted but needed hoeing, and quite far back along the path was the privy. Mr. Kinnear had a good deal of land, a pasture field, which was kept for the cow and horses, and a little orchard down by Young Street, and several other fields which were worked or in the midst of being cleared of trees. It was Jamie Walsh's father who looked after that, said Nancy. They had a cottage on the grounds about a quarter of a mile away. From where we were standing, we could just see the rooftop and chimney sticking up above the trees. Jamie himself was a bright and promising boy who ran errands for Mr. Kinnear, and he could play the flute. Or he called it a flute, but it was more like a fife. Nancy said he would come over some evening and play for us, as he liked to do it, and she did enjoy a little music herself, and was learning to play the piano. That surprised me, as it was not the usual thing for a housekeeper. But I said nothing. In the courtyard between the two kitchens, there were three lines strung up for the washing. There was no separate laundry room, but the things for the washing, the coppers and the wash tub and scrubbing board, were at present in the summer kitchen beside the stove, all good quality, and I was pleased to see they did not make their own soap, but used bought soap, which is far easier on the hands. They did not keep a pig, and I was just as glad, for pigs are too clever for their own good, and fond of escaping from their pens, as well as having a smell that is not at all agreeable. There were two cats, which lived in the stable, to keep down the mice and rats, but no dog, Mr. Kinnear's old dog Fancy having died. Nancy said she would feel easier with a dog about the place to bark at strangers, and Mr. Kinnear was looking for a good dog to go hunting with him. He was not a great sportsman in that way, but liked to shoot a duck or two in the autumn, or else a wild goose, which were very numerous, although too stringy for her taste. We went back into the winter kitchen, and along the passageway that led from it to the entrance hall, which was large, with a fireplace and stag's horns over it, and a good green wallpaper and a fine